Now I'm going to introduce our speaker for today. Jonathan Young is a psychologist in private practice in Santa Barbara. Jonathan assisted mythologist Joseph Campbell at seminars and was the founding curator of the Joseph Campbell Archives and Library. He teaches Jungian psychology at the Pacifica Graduate Institute and is presently director of the Center for Story and Symbol, which offers seminars on personal mythology throughout the country. Selections from his writings are posted at folkstory.com in the articles section. So it is my great pleasure to introduce Jonathan Young.
Thank you.
Small airplane. Pilot comes back from a little cockpit. There are three passengers, a monk, a college professor, and a college student who is very laid back, probably a little stoned. The pilot comes back and says, the plane is in terrible trouble. We don't even have time to land. We happen to have three parachutes on board. I'm taking one, jumps out of the plane. Three left, a college professor, a monk, and a college student. The college professor stands up and very pompous says, I'm one of the great thinkers of our time. I don't think humanity can get by without me. I'm going to use one of those parachutes out of the plane. We are left with a monk and a college student, very laid back. The monk starts, I'm a man of compassion. I should stand aside and let you use the last parachute. You're a young man, you have a long life. Hey, bro, don't sweat it. No worries. The smartest man in the world just jumped out of the back of the plane with my backpack. As a college professor, I like to relativize my work thoroughly in the proceedings here. I want to have an exchange and discussion throughout. I need hands to go up, and I'll tell you the guidelines for what I want to do. I have slight hearing losses and a slight visual thing, so otherwise I have no idea who's talking out of the room, staring out into space. I want to tell a story. I don't think you know the story, but I want to treat it like a dream. Old wisdom stories are guides to the inner life. They are guides to how we incorporate different levels of consciousness, different aspects of ourselves into the whole, into the most effective possible person we can be. So I want to use ideas from Joseph Campbell, ideas from Carl Jung to look at the images in an old story. Images can bridge the seen and the unseen, the conscious and the unconscious realms within. You can see a picture, and then you can start exploring its meanings, its implications, and that starts getting into areas that we can't see clearly within. That's the way I want to use it. If you study your own dreams, we're basically using dream techniques. So here are the guidelines for our little dream council. One, I'll only have three. First one is, please don't jump ahead in the story. If you know the story, and I stop and I say, what are you thinking about? And you say, oh yeah, right there toward the end, where we hold that when we get to the end. If you don't know the story, don't be guessing ahead. Let's take it like lived experience, as if it's unfolding as we discuss it. The second of the three guidelines is, if it reminds you of something personal, please feel free to share it. It's a public class, so, I mean, take care of yourself. If something tragic happened yesterday, maybe you don't want to talk about it. Actually, I've never once in 40 years had anybody share something that they were sorry they shared. So but I always say that. Actually, the part B of this one is of some importance. If it reminds you of a very long story, please give us the headline version, or we'll never use our time. Okay. That one has happened a few times. The third of the three guidelines is the only one I have much investment in. Please don't drift off into politics. I don't actually hear anything political in the story I'm about to tell, but Joseph Campbell, my old teacher, thought that there were political elements in every story. He called it the sociological function of storytelling. Okay. I don't want to go there. He had a complicated model. I could sum up his whole theory in two words. Inner, outer. I want to do the inner. The politics is the outer. It could be an interesting discussion, but we don't have that much time, because that's a long discussion. I want to talk about how the characters, images, events, and feelings in this story reflect the dramas inside. Our drama of accepting ourselves, of accepting our emotional life, of dealing with the different things we see in the mirror that Dr. Schoen was talking about, that stuff, the stuff of the inner project. So we're setting a policy arbitrarily, because we could have that decision, I just don't want to. We're setting that aside. With that, let us consider the story. Once upon a time, there was a poor family that lived hard by the edge of a wood. Actually, we're down in Louisiana. It's more like a bayou. This is an old Creole story. There are also Cajun versions of this name. I'm interrupting the story. I'm in the first sentence, but you'll see immediately what I'm going to do with this thing. We start off poor. Tenant farmers. These are folks that can't afford anything. That's a good story. A story that starts out in squalor has real prospects. Where can you go from here? Well, somewhere. If you start in a palace, you're going to be in a really troubling story, because the only place to go is down. All right, let me introduce our cast. We have a little tenant farm. It's not a good parcel. The better pieces, actually, people don't want to be near the woods because there's critters in there and there's bugs and you don't know. That's not ideal. I mean, we might like having a house by the forest or something, but we can afford to deal with it. Poor folks can't. This is a family of three women, and the landowner gave them the lousy parcel because they weren't in. Men of the family didn't think he'd make it as much. And let me see the three characters. Out here in the field, we can see Blanche, who is hardworking and diligent and kind and patient and loyal. And, oh, she does pretty much all the tending of the crops and the few animals they have. She also cleans that house, that shanty over there. Wreck that it is, and it's not easy to clean. She also irons the clothes. Now, that's a considerable challenge, because don't cast iron thing, but you have a hole, put it in there, and then it gets holding it on her back. She makes all the meals. Blanche. Pretty much Blanche's story. Oh, she does all this despite a rather serious handicap. One leg isn't quite as long as the other. It's like that from birth, and she is hobbling around, limping all day long, getting all that done without a complaint. Never, not a thought of a complaint. Now, over there on the porch in the shanty, you can see the other two characters in our family. That's Mama, the grouchy-looking older woman there, and Rose, the other daughter. And Rose is a little bit older, and Mama and Rose sit there in the shade, never lifting a finger, doing what they are good at, complaining. They complain all day long. Well, it's hot. Well, hey, it's hot for everybody. You're just hot for Blanche out there in the sun, as it is for them, that little bit of shade. But it is hot, all right. They're fanning themselves with those big fans you can get from the funeral parlor. Complaining about how hard their lives are, how they were really expecting something better, a nice house in town, fine dresses, a shady porch with big rocking chairs, mint juleps, and many gentlemen callers. But anyway, it's not happening. Now, in the politics of the family, Mama really loves one of her daughters better than the other. Now, Rose is mean and selfish and lazy and spiteful. I already described Blanche. Which one do you imagine Mama feels the warmest or loves the best? Any speculation here? Rose. Why is it always so? Why does the mean sibling always get the better attention? Anyway, that is right. That's how it is. Now, our story begins with Blanche, hardworking as always, out in the field. Mama calls out from the porch, "Blanche, Blanche, go get some water. Your sister is thirsty." The sister's not doing a thing. Rose is not doing a thing. Okay. Blanche puts down her work, goes into the shed and gets the bucket and a rope, and heads out to the well. They are poor. They don't have their own well. It's a piece down the road. The road's not much wider than this little tiny trail of a thing. A well that is shared for drinking water by several of the tenant farmer families, just clustered close together. So this is our journey. A story, an initiatory tale, will often have some movement in it. We go somewhere. We step away from our familiar pattern. That's stage one. Crossing over into some new experience. Now, essentially, I'm talking about an inner drama where we open a door somewhere in our mind. We open and step into something different to consider a new way of looking at ourselves. But now we're walking to the well because we're all blanched. Remember, we're all blanched. We've got a bucket and a rope and we're limping. We've got the handicap. I'm limping. And I get to the well, I'm going to have the scene up here. Because sitting by the well, looking old and tired, like I feel, is a woman that Blanche had never seen before. Well, Blanche sees almost nobody except Mama and Rose. There's a couple of neighbors, but they're real busy. And never goes to town. Blanche has had a very, very limited life. She sees this old woman wearing rags. I mean, she's got a shawl across her shoulder, but the holes are as big as the fabric. So she is old and dusty and kind of weathered from too much exposure, and her hair is all kind of wild and gray. And the old woman sees her and kind of brightens up a little bit. Oh, child, you've got a bucket. You've got a way to get some water. I'm really parched. Any chance you could get some water for me? I don't have any way to draw it up. Well, sure, Auntie, I can do that for you. No problem. And with this, Blanche lets the bucket down into the well, pulls up some water, and hands it to the old woman, who begins to drink and drink. And I'll get into the spirit of the thing here. Drink and drink. Puts away better than the better part of a bottle of water. Oh, that helps. Thank you, child. You have a sweet nature to you. And with that, Blanche draws up the water she needs and turns to go. And the old woman calls after, God bless you. You've got a generous soul. Good things will come to you. And with this, the old woman sits there as Blanche walks home. When Blanche gets home, Mama is furious at her. Mama starts yelling. Well, Mama does this amount of times. It's actually kind of random. Sometimes you don't even have any idea why. She's shouting at her. Maybe it's because she took a few extra moments with the water. So we don't know. And she's punching. You know, this is a very, by the way, dysfunctional family, we say in psychotherapy. And Rose, not one to miss an opportunity like this, is slapping Blanche and calling her names and kicking her. They're just wailing. But this happens rather often. Blanche is the designated scapegoat of the family. Those of us who see people as clients know that the person that comes in is usually the least troubled in the family. Usually it's the one that was the hippie, the one who got all the abuse, was not the cause of it. But still, they're the ones, despite all that abuse, that are the least broken and the most open to healing and learning. Something happened in this story. Something happened that has never happened before. Blanche ran off. She didn't. George just took it. Maybe it was that word of kindness of the Holy. We don't exactly know. We just had this brief little folktale. It's from the Southern, I found a collection of Southern folklore. She ran off into those woods behind the shanty. Now that's something, because you don't go in there unless you have to. It's nasty in there. You never know what kind of critter's going to bite your foot off, or whether you're going to go into a sinkhole because it's kind of half swamp. That's where she lives, which is kind of the only brush she could run. And here we are. We're all Blanche. And we're in this forest, and there's bugs, and ooh, it's getting kind of scary, and the Spanish moss kind of hangs down, and it'll look real ghostly, and we're thinking, oh, I've really done it this time. If I go back, I'll be in more trouble. Can't stay here. It's going to be evening. I'll hold this over. You just had a little dream. Well, we all had a variation on it. Believe me, the person sitting next to you had a very different dream from yours. Certain things will stand out as we go through a story. And Carl Jung and Joseph Campbell thought that these old tales were dreamlike. Maybe they came out of dreams. Maybe some shaman had a dream long ago and told it as a little teaching story, because the way you look at them, looking closely at the images and what they might suggest psychologically, we're going to take a totally emotional look at these images. And this is where you weigh in. What I need is to know what image held on to your attention. It may seem like a small thing, but if something reaches out in this story and holds onto your attention for a bit, essentially it's your own unconscious sort of speaking to you. And this image carries a message of some kind. And it's a message of consciousness, of wholeness. It's usually about something worth studying in yourself that you haven't thought about lately or need to give a little more attention to. So it's an incredibly simple little exercise with great potential. Who will jump in? What would Gretchen?
Running into the woods And despite her fear and despite its existential scariness, it was a refuge.
Amazing what can be a refuge. It depends how bad things get to be. Yeah. And the important thing is that she moved. She had always needed it, and that the instinct to look out for herself apparently is pretty new to her. And sometimes you'll listen to some friend's troubles and you just realize they've been putting up something unbelievable for all as long as I mean, therapists hear things. It's an incredibly long, big honor to be a therapist. I know some of you are in the field and the things we get to hear. And even though some of them are really kind of horrible, it's so good for the person to be unloading them. And, you know, I thought when I did the training, I said, I'm not sure I want to listen to these sort of awful things. No, there's a kind of beauty to it. It's like people that have survived tragic things have a loveliness to their character. So she has survived a great deal, and she runs off, and here she is. And things just got worse. But in a way, there's already hope, because at least things are moving. There's a possibility of change.
When she went back to the...
Right close to, right very close though, 2 inches.
When she went back to the house, she was holding the bucket, and when her mother and sister were waiting on her, she never let go. So when she came off, she's got water with her. She,
you know, I never saw it that way. No.
Yeah, so she knows she's safe, and she has the wherewithal to get further away, even though it's still at late afternoon and it's hot. She's got water with her.
It could be. The thing about a folktale, unlike mythology, like a novel, will give you all the details. It's a much longer form. So I had no idea she still has the bucket. I kind of thought that Rose grabbed that bucket when she got home and Rose got it. But it doesn't matter. She has, whether she has the bucket or not, she has the wherewithal to survive. And it's mostly in character. And what the images give us is what we have to draw on. After all, this is not a documentary. This is a dreamlike folktale, so it's really something from deep inside. And what it's reflecting is what we have emotionally in terms of character and so forth. Let me play it up.
I think she's run away like that into the forest before.
She thinks she's run into it. Maybe we've run into it before. Maybe the story kind of suggests it's the first time, but there was a first time. And whether we are in the first time or not is maybe not the most important thing. We are breaking with a set situation. And it's a set situation that has momentum because the given always does. Whether somebody says, this is the way things are, is common sense. By the way, the entire concept of common sense is suspect. Common sense is just somebody saying, I'm right. It's just a loud opinion. But it has force because we have the warning systems and alarms in here that warn us not to get out of line, not to get into trouble, not to hurt people's feelings, and they can really constrict our options, and we at some point need to get over them. You're next.
You can jump line.
I think you asked us what jumps out at you in the forest. What is that the question you asked, Jonathan?
In the story.
Yeah, because what I hear is that everybody's kind of rewriting the story or interpreting the story. I think we should stay strictly with his question, because he's leading us along.
Oh, that's a good one. Very good.
So, what jumped out at me in the story is, now we're in the far, we're in the wood, right? What came out from my unconscious? Is that what you asked?
Yeah.
Yeah. An ogre.
An ogre.
Now, let me take the first half of what he said, not the second half. Deal with what I said. There's a lot of space in this story, not more stuff. Of the images that I mentioned, which one grabs? Sorry, I didn't say it clearly enough. I didn't say it that way. The reason is this is a received story. It has come down through some process. It has survived, and it's a very old story. I've read a little bit of it. The folklore departments track the history and how the stories travel and things like that. And these condensed little things that have survived probably survived the way they are for some reason.
So what stood out for me in the story was the image of Lance working so hard and the mom and the sister sitting on the porch and not doing anything but complaining, which pretty much reminds me of kids and moms,
you've been one or the other. You've been some of each.
Mostly the one.
Mostly the end. Okay, so we have the working and the working. We have the mothers. We have the labors of life. And one thing in the stories is they'll reflect life back to us and what is our particular ordeals. There is endless work. When I was talking about all the things that Lynch is doing, anybody kind of identify with that? Do you sort of feel like, oh, yeah, I get that feeling? And anybody have the feeling looking over at the roses and mamas of life and there is no chance of pleasing. There's no chance of ever doing enough. And yet, I can't see inside of Lynch's mind. I can see inside of my own. I know I would think maybe if I tried just a little harder, that's the first people. That one doesn't work, but it's a starting place.
I just see it as a transformative moment in her life. And at this point, where does she go from here? And then just identify with it.
Yeah. It is a transformative story. It's an initiatory tale. And that is about change. Strange, but it's, in a way, it's about change. And yet, all of the things that are going to be at the end of the story are kind of already implied. So while we need to change in some ways, it's often a situation of claiming what we already have.
So what stood out to me was that Blanche has been a slave to her sister and mother. And when she goes to the well, she finally meets someone that really appreciates who she is and what she's doing. And for the little thing that she actually did for that woman, just give her water, you know. And the woman was so grateful and never complained. And Blanche did it. Unconditionally,
but
love.
Bullseye. This is absolutely the heart of the story, that moment right there. This woman in these parts is called a Conjure Woman. She's a magical figure. In other stories, she would be Glinda, the Good Witch of the North. She is a mentor, an ally, and a transcendent figure. She has qualities that are beyond our understanding. If we're thinking psychologically, this is the Holy Spirit, this part of the divine, the higher self, the archetype of the self. I'm skipping through theories here. But depending on what set of language you use, that we have better angels available to us within. And we have neglected them or have not had a form of contact with this higher consciousness. And if we find it somehow, usually by a fluke, and show good character, the bit of generosity, here we have an unbelievably poor person who gives. All she's got to give is a little effort, but she gives, and it is greatly received. Now, if we take this character, the Conjure Woman, as something beyond ordinary life, why couldn't she get the water herself? But there are many stories of encounters with angels or the Grateful Dead, and the band got their name from mythology. This is a kind of ghost that needs help of some kind. Characters from other worlds sometimes need practical help, something that they can't do, some small thing we can do. And if we go into our self-pity and say, well, I don't have anything going for me, I don't have anything to offer. Well, if you believe it, you don't. But if you say, okay, limited as my options are, what do I have to give? And if you think that way, there is something to give. And something about that good character is, well, it's rewarded in ways, we're not going to jump ahead yet, but in ways that are more than a drink of water. Well, it's got something to jump. I'm going to go over this for one more.
Well, for me, it was the same image, but what I really resonated with was the water and how refreshing it was for the old woman who was suffering. And I could taste the water, feel the water, and it just sort of, it was totally nourishing, you know. So it was the coolest of the water in the room.
Water as a symbol, Jung thought, was one of the most important in our dream life. After all, we are water-based creatures. We need it. On a warm day, we become aware, very aware of it. We are, a scientific definition of the human body is a carbon event in an aqueous environment. We really, really need water. We need air, and then we really need water. So water, the water of life, is a common metaphor. The story of the woman at the well is one of the classic images. It's in the scriptures and it's in stories older than the scriptures. This is the gatekeeper to the unseen world. A well is a portal to the deep places. And what is down there? Healing water. And we have the rope and the bucket. We also have the guide, the mentor, the transcendent figure here who will be our helper. And I want to start going forward in the story. If you've got an image, you can jump in the next time I sort of stop and ask for hands. I purposely left ourselves near the ogres, that is, in peril, because I like the old serials, it's the perils of Paul Dean, where you stop and take away from me. We're in trouble. This is not a safe place, it's certainly not a pleasant place. It is a forest. Forest imagery is very popular in myth and folklore. It usually represents the unconscious. It is some part within us that we'd rather not visit, and the story invariably gets us stuck there, as does life. Shadow work in the Jungian model is going toward the part of our life, of our inner life, that is uncomfortable, intentionally turning toward the things that we'd rather avoid, and not finding a way of making it go away, which you can do through mantras. Okay, what do you want? You're giving me nightmares. What do you want? What's going on over here? And start the conversation. And actually, sometimes what it wants is pretty reasonable. What it wants is maybe difficult, but something worth considering. And you end up coming to terms with shadow. That is the phrase. Not annihilating, not eradicating the discomforts within, but working something out. Finding a rapprochement, finding some place at the table for our fears, for our sorrows, for whatever is uncomfortable. It's a different approach. There's a range of models out there. This is the one I find fascinating because it is more inclusive. It's a very, very much emphasizing wholeness. And so we're in the forest. We don't visit with an ogre, but something does happen. There is an encounter. The old woman shows up. Now, she was way over there. The forest was way over there. So go figure space out. But she's of some greater dimension than we understand. She says, "Child, what are you doing in a place like this?" Reasonable question. Good question. This is not, don't make any sense. Now, Blanche may have been there some other time. Maybe an animal got away or something. But you tried to avoid such a place. Well, Blanche says, I got home and my mama was really angry at me and she was hitting me. I don't know, she does that a lot, but she was yelling at me and my sister was calling her names and kicking me and stuff. I don't know why, but I just ran away. But now I'm in real trouble. It's scary in here. I don't know what to do. Oh, well, would it help if you came and stayed at my place tonight? Oh, yeah, that'd be great because they forget things. Tomorrow won't matter at all, but right now I'm in hot water. Okay, well, you could stay at my place on one condition. But by the way, if a transcendent figure in a story ever imposes a condition, pay attention. It's some tricky little thing, but sometimes, a lot of times in these stories, we should be transgressive, we should be rebellious and not do oracle. If the guardian angel tells you what to do, do it. Just do it. Here's the condition. I have some critters, some animals in my place. I don't like it if people laugh at them or make fun of them. I think that hurts their feelings. So if you don't laugh at my animals, you can stay at my place tonight. Oh, yeah, okay, I'll promise. With that, they headed off in a direction that Blanche had never gone in before. Well, now Blanche hadn't gone to the woods at any time, but frankly, you can't go in that direction. Everybody knows the bushes and the thorns and everything. It's just too thick. There's no path. You can't get through. But when the old woman headed off in that direction, there was a path. It had opened up, and she didn't see any move, but there was a path, a nice big path. And walking along, that's kind of interesting and strange. And she walked past a little opening, and there was a clearing of sorts, and she saw something very strange. There were two hatchets floating up in the air, having a fight. Like two real big guys were fighting with hatchets, but no guys, just the hatchets. Okay. We get to the old woman's house. It is not impressive. It's a broken down shanty, just like the hovel we live in with Mama and Rosa. But it is far into the woods, and there are some creatures. But they are a little strange. One of them is a duck. Well, it might be a duck. I don't know. It's got three legs, it's got blue feathers. It's, anyway, duckish. There's a cow with a head at each end, and the sound isn't like a moo, like a cow, more like a mule or something. The story goes on in more detail. Lots of more animals that I'm taking time for here. An important detail is Blanche does not laugh. We go inside, and the woman sits down and says, "Well, we should be getting to work on dinner. There's some wood. Now, start a fire over there, and we'll get something going there."
and she sits down by the fire, takes her head off, sets it in her lap, and begins to braid her own hair. Now, I personally think this is a moment in the story when Blanche realizes she is dealing with an unusual character. After she's all done braiding her hair, she puts her head back on. And by then, Blanche's got the fire going, and she comes over, and she says, okay, get some water and put a pot on there. All right, now when it's boiling, put this grain of rice in there. She hands her one grain of rice. Blanche does not make fun of this or question her mental health or anything. She just waits for the water to boil and drops the grain of rice in there. The whole bowl is full of cooked rice, dirty rice with cooking spices and all that, great fish on it. I mean, it's a gumbo thing there, and it's really looking fine. And they sit down. I moved the story. Well, the first thing the old woman gave her was a bone, and the bone had no meat on it. She didn't question it. She just put it in the water. That's what turned into the gumbo. The rice was the second piece. She gave the rice and told her to put it in a bowl. It was an empty bowl, and that became the cooked rice. It was two dishes, and they sat down and had a fine supper. I mean, the best meal that Blanche had ever had. And then the old woman said, all right, let's wash the dishes, and a little something special. Let's go out the back porch, and I got a little something in mind for you. And so they finish cleaning up and go out the back porch as well. It's pretty grand. It's a plant. It's a cut tree. Cut it in half across a couple of stones. But you could sit on it. And she sits down in the back, and there's a clearing about half the size of this room. You can't see it all, but we're sitting. And then there are bushes and trees and stuff in the forest. The woods start to begin. Because space has to be cleared, so space is pretty quite precious. And out of the bushes start coming rabbits. Lots and lots of rabbits. Well-dressed rabbits. The gentleman rabbits have three-piece suits and top hats. The lady rabbits have full hoop skirts and parasols and bonnets and the whole thing. And they're all carrying musical instruments. Trombones and guitars and washboards for rhythm and tubas for bass, and they start playing. And these rabbits are all terrific musicians, and they're playing the real hot jazz, and this is good. And then after a couple numbers, one of them starts singing, and then a number of them, quite a few of them, can sing, and you've got the singing and the jazz, and this little rabbit, if you remember. And then after a couple more numbers, some of them start dancing. And you got the Virginia Reel, and you got the Cakewalk, and you got this whole Showboat Review, all done by rabbits. Now, I didn't know Blanche even heard of showboats or reviews, but she's certainly having a big old time, and this thing was on for a while. And then, at one point, Blanche falls asleep. She's had actually a pretty long and exciting day, and even the show was going on, and she slumps over against the old woman, who, with her free hand, gestures for the rabbits to stop and go, and they all drift back into the bushes and go away. The old woman, frail as she is, manages to kind of gather Blanche up and get her in, get her to sleep. And Blanche has a real good night's sleep. In the morning, they have some breakfast, and the old woman says, it's going to be time for you to head home pretty quick, but I want you to have a gift, a little souvenir of your time here. Out back, there are some chickens. Here's a little basket. Go take some eggs. And Blanche said, oh, thank you. And she starts to head. Oh, child, some of the eggs will talk to you. Take the eggs that talk to you. Leave the other ones be. I've read several variations of the story. Some have all the eggs talk, and say they want to take the ones that call your name. The variation of the name of the story is the talking eggs. And so we're all Blanche. Get the guys deal with it. These stories are following somebody to learn certain things, and I think the lessons are way beyond the gender limitations. Anyway, we're back and we find chickens and there's some eggs there. We've seen eggs before, but now some of them are regular plain brown eggs, and in there among them are some beautiful eggs that are obviously made of gold and aren't just made of gold, but they've got all kinds of decoration and jewels. I'm seeing something like made by Tiffany or something here, some incredible Fabergé kind of thing. Well, we reach over toward one of those beautiful, elegant, golden works of art, and it doesn't say anything. The old woman said, take the ones that talk to you. We move our hand over slightly, and one of those brown eggs says, take me, take me. you know, would check out one of the other Fabergé eggs. Just not a word. Another one of the brown eggs. Take me, take me. It's like that. You get that. Now, I know that Blanche really wants to take those gold eggs. I do. Don't you? I mean, she takes her moment. She's sitting there struggling a little bit. The old woman said, take the eggs that talk to you. She ends up taking the one. She ends up with a little basket of four plain brown eggs. Comes back in, the old woman sees what she's got. They go, okay, Chuck. All right, it's been really nice having you visit. Now you all get her home there. You know, in the South, you say y'all. Unless you're referring to a group of people, then you say, all y'all. She had lunch just as she's leaving, just as she's stepping out of the door, the old woman calls out, oh, child, oh, one thing, remember when you get home, get close to home, y'all toss those eggs over your shoulder one at a time, something special will happen. All right, bye. And so we head home. And it's a nice day like today. It's a little warm like today, but we're down in the South, you know, it gets warm. We're walking along and feel good. I'm not sure why we feel good. Blanche is not sure why she feels so good. She's kind of skipping a little bit and just, well, of course, it's been a little affirming experience. It's been an unusually kindly moment. Something else. There's something else. And it takes a while to notice it, but she is not limping. There was no moment of healing, no little ceremony, no laying on of hands, no special herbal tonics or anything. But that leg that was never quite long enough grew out. And you know, if you have never walked in balance in your entire life, and suddenly you can't, it's a big deal. It's a really big deal. Whoa! She never really skipped before. She could do things she couldn't do before, and she's like liking it. Oh, not so much that she forgets. She gets close to home to toss those eggs over her shoulder. That first egg flies over her shoulder, and it breaks open. And it's not egg glob inside the egg breaks. Gold coins. Big ones. I don't know the pieces of eight, the moons or something like that, big old valuable precious, a whole bunch of far more than could be in an egg. She gathers all these gold coins, puts them in that basket, walks along a little further, throws that second egg over her shoulder. Boom. Diamonds, big cut diamonds, a whole handfuls of them. She put all these diamonds in that basket. Walks along a little further, throws that third egg over her shoulder, it explodes. Something's coming out of the cloth, streaming out of it. Catching cloth out of the air, beautiful silk dresses. A dozen handmade silk dresses, exquisite, fine. She's actually going to drape them kind of all over herself, manages somehow to toss that fourth egg over her shoulder, and this is the strangest of all. And she looks down at it, and it looks like a little charm for a bracelet or something like it. It's a little tiny, exquisitely carved carriage with two little horses. And as she's watching, this thing that's smaller than her thumb sure looks like one of those horses moves. And as she stares, the thing starts to grow. It starts to swell up and up and up and up until it is a full-size carriage and beautifully matched white horse. Just beautiful. I mean, this is like for royalty or something. This is something really, I mean, she's never seen such a thing. What to do? I guess my ride has just delivered to me. She climbs up there, puts her basket over there, and stacks up those nice dresses and rides home in style. Gets home feeling good about everything, and Mama is real nice to her. Well, isn't this fine? My goodness, look at all the good diamonds, gold coins, dresses. Mom wants to know all about, well, Blanche is a good girl. She tells her all about the old woman in the house. And then, oh, it's wonderful. Well, I don't see why you have to do any chores today. I mean, with all this excitement, you want to have a little something to eat, take a nap or something? Mama never let her out of chores. What the heck? But, yeah, well, actually, it was pretty exciting. She has a little sandwich. She goes to sleep. Mama calls Rose. Look at all this stuff, Rose. Here's what I want you to do. I want you to go in that forest. Find that old woman. You go stay with her. You get a bunch more of this stuff. Then we're going to take off. We're going to buy a nice house in town and have mint jewels and gentlemen callers. Rose does not want to go into that forest one little bit. Mama, look at all this stuff. Let's just take it. Blanche is asleep. Let her go. Let's go. Come on.
No, Mom's face starts getting really, really red. It's not enough. You do as I say. You go get one.
Now, at this moment in the story alone, the greed, the part of us that would get greedy in a moment, instead of counting our blessings anyway, this is the story. And so, now the rogue side of ourselves has to head out. And she has to do it. When Mom gets like that, you better do it. You better do it fast. She heads off and it's sticky in there and it's scary and there's bugs and you don't know where to step. Woo, now get them. She doesn't look around for the old woman very much. She just sort of stands there whimpering and being sorry for herself. But the old woman finds her because otherwise we wouldn't have much of a story. So she says, Are you that old woman that my sister stayed with? And, well, yeah, and I guess I am. Well, can I stay with you at your house too? Well, yeah, I guess if you want, on one condition. What's that? Well, I got some animals, and I don't like it if folks laugh at them or make fun of them. If you promise not to laugh at my critters, you can stay at my place. Oh, yeah, okay, I won't do that. And so they head off to the old woman's house in a direction that Rose had never been. We're not sure, actually, if Rose had ever been in the woods before, but there's never been a path there. She knows that. She knows you can't go in that way. Everybody knows you cannot go in that direction. But when the old woman headed off, there was a path. And as Rose is walking along, she sees an opening and then sees two hatchets having some big old fun. They get to the house and there's a duck with blue feathers and three legs. There's a cow with a handsy, funny looking. I mean, they are funny looking. She is laughing. She laughs so hard the story tells us that her ribs are hurting. Go inside. The old woman goes over and sits down there. Get to some fire going there, get some water boiling, we'll get to work on some supper here. Do I have to? I don't know how. Blanche always says, well, yeah, you better get started. Child, we're not going to get anything to eat. So Blanche goes over there, she's actually making a lot of smoke and stuff before she gets any fire going, and the old woman sits down by the fire, takes off her head, and begins braiding her own hair. And Blanche shakes her sister's chin. And she swoops over there and takes the old tail.
Wait, is this Rose or Mama?
Excuse me, this is Rose. I got the name of it. This is Rose. And Rose snatches the old woman's head away and says, I'm not giving you your head back. No, you promised. Give me some eggs. I gave my sister. Yeah, okay. I was going to give you eggs anyway. I'll cut my head back. So she gives her head back and the old woman continues braiding her hair. I think hold the story right here. You all already see this is not going very well right now, but don't guess ahead. And of the things I've mentioned, the images that have come at you, what grabs you? What? Now, if you go off on some digression, if it reminds you of something, that you go down that road, you go down that road with you too. That's interesting.
Well, it's like the goose that laid the golden egg story. It's like the goose that laid the golden egg story, and he disagreed. That it's like, wow, you could have had this great life, but you're risking it all.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, the greed is an astounding part of this tale right there. There is so much. I want to be quick to say we're in a dream or a dream-like story. So while there is great wealth, they start off poor. We're talking about poverty of spirit. And we're talking about the riches of consciousness. We're talking about gaining things that are, you know, not just the tangible kind of wealth, but there's greed for that too. And the ability to be peaceful with ourselves and with our lot in life, interesting, because sometimes the most grasping people in these stories don't get as much as those that were happy all along, that were already full in a way. Right back here.
What grabbed me was, there's a way where there is no way.
Oh yeah, the path.
There is a way where there was no way. And that's a common element in these stories, and we are so limited by the kind of consciousness we have. We are aware there's more, but we don't know how to get there. And that old story, there's a lot of different paths, a lot of different ways to try to tease out these riches. But when we make the right connection, and the heart of the story is making that connection with your consciousness, the guardian angel, whatever we want to call this character, what that represents inside, she knows where the path is, or she'll cause it to happen. And the moment of surprise where we have felt we had a certain range of options and possibilities in this, the moment of surprise when we realize there's a break here, there's a way to move I did not know about, that's exciting. Who else is back here?
Yeah.
Well, the more the story goes on, the more I want Blanche to do well, the more I want Rose to do
really
bad. I have the same generosity of spirit. I don't want anything good to come to Rose and Mom. Now, I have four sisters. Accounts for a great deal of my brain damage. You know these stories that have the wicked stepsisters? They don't have to be stepsisters. Ray and her siblings will do something better.
You know, one of the things that's going to cause a lot of trouble is grabbing the head. You don't want to mess around with something transcendent. You don't want to try to fool Mother Nature. The absolute hubris of the human being here is the...
Absolutely. Very important point. Her arrogance, our arrogance, in terms of a psychological model, now we need a mark. Okay. I'll give you a second. Okay, we've got the boundary between the conscious inner life and the unconscious down here. We've got ego, the part of us that goes by our name. We've got persona, this is Jungian, basic Jungian theory. Persona is the ego project of presenting ourselves to other life as performance. This is the part of you that decided what to wear this morning, is concerned about the way we look in the eyes of others. This is an important part of life, not the most important part, but it's not something to slack. There are a lot of people that can do a little better at that. Then in the Jungian model, there is a very important aspect, the archetype of the self, which I think is the conjure woman in this story. This is our guardian angel. This is the Holy Spirit, this is the higher consciousness, whatever you want to call it. Making this connection right here is the heart of the story, and it's the heart of the path, regardless of what model we're using. Jung has one way of saying it, there are lots of ways to describe this. It's getting out of our own way. It's called ego relativization, if you've done much serious meditating. Getting the suit of clothes that we see in the mirror out of the way, and the truer, deeper, wiser self, our better angels down here, the control, making that connection. Once we shift the control, so that ego is not so much in the driver's seat, but our deeper wisdom is, then paths show up that weren't around before. But we need to treat this with respect to this part. See something strange here and takes advantage of it by snatching the head away. Well, the bond is broken. We're not going to make much progress. Hold on.
There's a movie called Transcendent. You hear that with Johnny Depp?
The movie of?
Transcendent.
Oh, I didn't see that movie.
Did you hear about it?
It's a recent movie called Transcendence, was it called?
Yeah.
I saw some ads on TV, and I like Johnny Depp, but I don't know much about it. The title, I should have, as a consciousness explorer, I should have been, but I didn't go yet.
It strikes me that there's a kind of integrity and a respect and awareness of others that gets beyond her own needs. And even though she's tempted and she's in conflict, it's always that basic respect for, and it really involves other people. And this doesn't make sense to me, but I respect it and I don't try to change her into something.
That shows considerable respect for this old woman who's actually kind of strange with weird animals there. She doesn't laugh. The Rose side, and I want to talk about it that way, that we are also Rose and we are also Mama. And on our more fearful days, our more defensive days, when we're more judgmental toward ourselves and others, we can be not so gracious to others, and there's a price in that.
Sorry, you invited us to tell a personal story. The greed and the goose and the golden egg story is very personal for me. I helped found a company locally, and it was bought by these greedy people who immediately set about reversing everything that we had done to make the company great, just to squeeze extra bits out.
Yeah, and sometimes the greedy moves work, and sometimes they backfire and ruin the thing that was beautiful, and end up ruining the profits, you can't tell. And so we are now in the forest, as Rose this time. And we have met the old woman despite our lack of motivation and our general slacking attitude. We have gotten to the place that we sought, which is a magical place which we are not treating with much respect. Now, she's trying to make some food. Actually, it takes her a while to get some water boiling. The woman brings that bone over. She says, this is a bone. There's no meat on this bone. There's not even any fat. I don't think a dog would be interested in this bone. The old woman just kind of looks at her. She finally puts it in the water, but it does not turn into gumbo. The old woman gives her one grain of rice and gestures to the bowl, and she says, this is one piece of rice.
That's not enough for anybody. She throws it away. They end up having a supper of really thin soup. Oh, there's no dancing rabbits in this part of the story. The old woman's not in the mood. But she does stay the night. Rose doesn't sleep very well. She's thinking about all the money and the nice house and the mint juleps and the many gentlemen callers. So in the morning, there's a little breakfast, and she says, this is where I get the egg cart. I'll do the dishes, the old woman says. Here's the basket out the back where the chickens are, takes them. Oh, child, only take the eggs that talk to you. Now I barely need to tell the next section of the story. In service to the narrative here, she goes back and finds the chickens and their eggs, and she sees the beautiful golden eggs all jeweled and all the handcraft and all of that, and plain old brown eggs. She reaches for one of those jeweled eggs and sings it to her. Her hand just kind of moves over, and that plain brown egg says, take me, take me. Well, she checks out all the eggs, and you know what she does. She takes the golden eggs. I mean, a bird in hand. I mean, she knows a good thing when she sees it. I mean, she's nobody's fool. Here's a controlling, that the key word is control. That's the key word in fearful defensive behavior is control. I know what I know. Yeah, but there's a lot more that I don't know. And if I had some way of factoring in a little humility, a little trust of the mystery, bigger things would be possible. Instead, I'll go for the short term because I can understand it, because I have more control, conscious control of that. And so she ends up with a basket of golden eggs. And she heads for home, and the old woman calls after her, child, remember, when you get near home, toss those eggs over your shoulder one by one. Something special will happen. I love this part of the story. And so, we hurry home thinking about how rich we're going to be and what a fine house and all the pretty dresses. Ooh, toss that first egg over her shoulder. It's not egg love. Spiders, big, hairy spiders, the kind that can jump, and they're coming after me. They're on heading in my direction. So she starts to move a little closer, a little faster. She tosses the next egg over her shoulder. Snakes. Big snake. Come right after her. Whoa, whoa. She's moving along. What the heck? I don't want these snakes after me. And this is not going as well. And she moves along and manages to toss the third egg over. Wolves, a whole pack of wolves jump. I don't know how to get the egg. We are not running for all we. I want to hold this story for a second here. A little comment, a little editorial comment on the story. I understand I am broke, but I am understanding. If I were in this situation, I don't know about you, but I personally would stop throwing eggs. But greed, like hope, springs eternal. And we're running as fast as we can to get away from the spiders and the snakes and the wolves. And she tosses the last egg over her shoulder. Gators, a whole bunch of them. And you know, they can actually move a lot faster than you imagine. And they got the big teeth, and they're coming at her, and she is running as fast as she can. Mama up on the porch looks and sees Rose coming toward her, followed by gators and snakes and spiders and wolves. And Mama does not pause for a moment. She's out of there, and the only way to run is into those woods. And Rose does not even slow down, trying to get away from certain death runs into those woods. And those gators and wolves and snakes and spiders run after her. Meanwhile, Blanche is out in the field doing some work. She's very diligent even after getting all this stuff. She's out just getting things done. Comes in when it's time to make a meal, doesn't see Mama and Rose complaining on the porch, which is where they've always been. Anyway, she makes the meal. They don't show up. What the heck? The next meal, and by the next meal, she's not making their portions. After about a week, she doesn't know what the heck happened, but figures that they've just taken off. Actually, she's not entirely surprised, just abandoned. So she gets a note to the landlord, has to have the neighbor send it. The landlord sends out this real terse note. The lease is a part of family of three, clear out. Okay, so a few days later, she packs up that beautiful carriage with everything. Well, actually, all that's in there is a basket of gold coins and diamonds and sack of dresses, nothing else worth taking. She has one of the dresses on, and for the first time in her life, rides into town. That's a little town not that far away, never been there before. Looks around, sees a real pretty house for sale, one of the nicest houses in town, inquires about it. She gets only a little bit of her money, moves into this nice house, gets to know the folks in the store. They're kind of worried about the roof, and she says, well, why don't you fix it? We don't have the money. Oh, well, I can lend you the money.
So she gives them a no-interest loan, and she starts helping poor people around town and settles into this new life. And that is where the story ends. I actually have a couple of speculations of thoughts after the story, but I want to hold the tail right there and see where it's taking. What images have held on to you, got you off thinking about something?
Well, I love the fact that this now that she's doing well, she's helping others do well.
She did have a generous spirit, had not abandoned her in her good fortune. My speculations are that she settles into a long and good life there, helps neighbors, starts a little fund, or gives some money to the United Way or something like that, and generally enjoying herself in her old age. One day, there is a knock at the door. She's been there a year or two. It's Mom. And Rose, looking the worst for wear, all scratched up and sunburned. The rags that were their clothes are pretty much threads at this point. And they have come to throw themselves at her mercy. She takes them in, makes tea, and shows them how to use the shower, and gets some nice dresses and things. And they visit for a short time. She says, "I really have something to do. Please have some more tea and cookies." And their daughter went up those cookies. And she heads out, comes back an hour later, and says, "Watch your house. It's about 4 doors down. It's nice. It's got a full porch across the front and a part on one side. You always talked about that. And I'm ordering rocking chairs for you. They'll be in the counter at the store. And you can." And they moved in, and they sat on their porch and had endless supply of mint juleps. And you know what they did? They complained all day long. Because there never were any gentlemen callers. And that's where I would end the story. Now, that last part I completely made up, but I didn't like the fact that the shadow element of the story was out wandering the force of us. It's still around. It never goes away. You don't annihilate those uncomfortable parts of yourself. They need to be coped with somehow. Now, when I first wrote a little ending, I had them next door, and I said, no. A little further down, but still in the neighborhood where I can keep an eye on, partly to just know what they're up to so they don't sneak up on me, partly because they might be useful sometime. Now, I had this fantasy. One day, the Hell's Angels rolled into town. They decided to pick this little town for their annual gathering, and they're scaring everybody. Is Blanche going to deal with that? Not so well. Mom, Rose, your gentleman callers have arrived. See how you can use her. I tried to, you notice that it's a variation on the Cinderella story. It's from the Cajun, the French area of Louisiana, and probably someone brought this over, and then the local got hold of it, made it here. And the difference between the Perrault or Grimm Cinderella stories is she, in those stories, she was actually once an aristocrat. Her mother actually had royal lineage. In this one, we start off poor. In the familiar Cinderella story, she is poor because she's had a decline. That suggests that if you ever rise to a better place in consciousness, you were always meant to be there. I kind of like that little implication. Both stories turn on the meeting of the fairy godmother. That's the heart of the story. Even the older versions where there is no fairy godmother turn on the meeting with birds that will be the magical assistants. We don't entirely solve the problem through ego effort, through plans and decisions. As a therapist, I'm constantly dealing with people who come in. I've got a big decision to make. And they honestly think it's earnest, but I've got to sort of show them the error of this thinking, that if you just make the right decision, and sometimes there's a speech that goes with it, I need to decide whether to stay with this boss or this husband or leave, and then I'm going to go tell off. And I think if we could have solved through a concrete decision and making a speech, we would have solved it years ago. That's all coming from a fairly superficial place in ourselves, the part that encounters the outside world. The big changes are going to happen out of sight. It's a much more subtle and reflective process, and there's less control. The big transformative events will be more like yielding and less like empowering. I don't have anything against empowering, but I find it somewhat limited in how much we can do that way. And I think the big changes come from a deeper place. But that's a theoretical model.
I've got a thing to hand out to you. Would you pass those back to me, please? Got some over here.
That's what you want. This is a little one-page summary of some ideas from Joseph Campbell that I'll race through very quickly because I'm almost out of time.
And my website's on here. I've got articles and things, that chapters of my books are in there that you can read if you're curious about how to do this for yourself. My day job is I do seminars, one-day seminars in various places. We do them in Santa Barbara as well. And if you're curious, you can look at that in there. I have glasses. This is not a summary made by Joseph Campbell. A friend of mine wrote this thing up, and I admire his summary. The first is to read myths with the eyes of wonder. Myths transparent to their universal meaning. Their meaning transparent to its mysterious source. That's what we've been doing here. We've not just been telling a story. We've been looking through the images as if they were windows into mysterious worlds. And then you can start speculating what that is. I would call it, in general, higher consciousness. If you're more theological than that, you might bring more spirituality to it. But it's a mysterious source. There is wisdom beyond the images in these stories. They are not just entertainments, and they're not primarily children's stories. They are guidance for adults. Two, read myths in the present tense. Eternity is now. We're discussing the story as something about our lives, not just something that would happen in the days of carriages and horses in Louisiana long ago, or if we pull some story out from Greek mythology or Egyptian mythology, it doesn't just apply to them. They are timeless. Three, read myths in the first person plural. The gods and goddesses of ancient mythology still live within you. This is where I was saying, we are Blanche, we are Rose, we are Mama, and we have access within each of us to a conjure woman or a fairy godmother or a personal transcendent guide of some kind. Now, whether you consider that a metaphysical event, a spiritual event, or just a psychological encounter with a deeper sense of yourself, doesn't really matter on a practical level. Because the way it works is in a dream or in a veil of emotion, it works in a slightly mysterious way. And what that is open to speculation. For any myth worth its salt exerts a powerful magnetism. Notice the images and stories you are drawn to and repelled by. Investigate the field of associated images and stories. That's why the method was, which image holds your attention? If you study a dream, what image in that dream stands out? What story do you like? What story do you remember from childhood? What movie did you like a lot? This isn't just old mythology or folklore. Any story that has really held your attention, your 10 favorite stories, look down and see if there's any kind of a common element to them. I don't mean all 10, but 3 or 4 out of 10 kind of variations on the same story, you're probably reading your story. Go study it closely. See if you can find other variations. See if you can find some variation from another culture. See if there's more in there than you have noticed. That was my reminder to, only a couple minutes left, we should have stopped. The clock in my head. Once I hear story time is different from regular time. It has its own elasticity, so I have to be careful, watch the clock at the same time as we're entering into the imagination. Point 5, look for patterns. Don't get too lost in the details. What is needed is not more specialized scholarship, but more interest. Disciplinary vision. Make connections. Break old patterns of earlier thought. I think Ted was addressing that to the Academy, but for our purposes, if you have a set way of looking at a story, see if you can find another set of rules. That there are various ways to pounce on these images to see what they reveal. Try to shake yourself out of your usual way of approaching things. 6, re-sacralize the secular. Even a dollar bill reveals the imprint of eternity. He's referring to a lecture that Joseph Campbell once did on the mythology of a dollar bill. And he would turn it over and say, see the eye. There's the eye seeing eye of trans, all seeing eye of trans. See the parent. He took image by image. See the cluster of stars and what they represent. And they sort of come out of Americana early in the birth of this country, but actually the roots go way back, partly through Masonry, but they're very, very early. That is to say, mythic images, profound symbolic images are all around us in our culture. We don't have to go to India to find them. Our world is saturated with them. We do need to be a little more alert to what they're saying to us. Point 7, if God is everywhere, then this can be generated anywhere, anytime, by anything. Don't let your romantic aversion to science blind you to the Buddha in the computer chip. Don't just think that certain old stories carry old wisdom. The stories on good TV series carry guidance for a lifetime, not just how to conduct ourselves with others, but how to understand the deep inner life. After all, there are only so many stories. And people that keep retelling them are drawing on old patterns, and the old patterns were there for initiatory wisdom. 8, know your tribe. Myths never arise in a vacuum. They are the connective tissue of a social body which enjoys synergistic relations with dreams. That's the private myth. and rituals, that is, the enactment of myth. Both Campbell and Carl Jung thought that these were very dreamlike, and that if you want a deeper sense of your mythology, study your own dreams. It will come up from night after night after night. And if you want to go even deeper into the emotional engagement with this entire realm of the mythic imagination, set up rituals. In a ritual, you essentially step inside the story and enact it for a time and let it seep into your bones. Point 9, expand your horizons. Any mythology worth remembering will be global in scope. The earth is our home and humankind is our family. Campbell repeatedly noted that mythology is profoundly ecological. It's all coming out of nature. There's like a forest in there somewhere. Very much about our life on this earth. 10, read between the lines. Literalism kills, imagination quickens. You are very good sports about that. That is, to not just think, well, the bucket's a bucket's bucket. No, a bucket is a container, it's the Holy Grail, it's the water bucket. As soon as you can get figurative with it, you can get more things. I've got some other things up here. If you're going to need another copy for a friend, we're also going to post this talk if you want some friend to listen to it, the assistant for the class. If you want to go to my website, there are other things like this. Thank you for a wonderful time.